This Strategy and Business podcast was produced in conjunction with Knowledge at Wharton. Money isn't the key to successful innovation. In fact, many companies spend far less than their competitors on R&D to achieve far better performance. To learn why that's the case, Strategy and Business and Knowledge at Wharton spoke with Kevin Dayhoff, a partner at Booz & Company, and Carl Ulrich, Wharton Professor of Operations and Information Management. In this second part of a three-part series, Dayhoff and Ulrich discuss the competitive advantages of global innovation networks, the challenges companies face in cross-border R&D collaboration, and how models of collaboration will likely evolve.
How has the ongoing globalization of innovation affected companies? Carl, maybe you could start us off.
Well, you have to step back and say, what do you really mean by globalization? So let me take one angle on that, which is that most companies, I think, are growing in their global reach in terms of the customers they serve. And what that does is it exposes the company to a much greater diversity in its customer base than it's accustomed to in a domestic market or in a single regional market. And one of the challenges in innovation is how to be responsive to local needs, how to be responsive to diversity in needs that might vary by region. And many firms have developed mechanisms for local customization, for local product development, for local innovation that allow them to adapt to regional preferences. For example, a food products company like Unilever will have divisions in specific regions and will often have regional variants for things like margarine or cooking oil or something like that. One of the challenges is how do you respond to that regional variability? But then the advantage of being a large company is that you can achieve scale economies. You can achieve efficiencies by serving lots of regions. So a big challenge is how do you take that variety that's generated at the periphery and find a way to establish some commonality that lets you leverage some core platform of products or services and serve the world more efficiently. So it's this process of identifying variety at the periphery, bringing it back into the core, and then finding a way to deploy it efficiently that I think is one of the real challenges that global enterprises face.
I completely agree. I actually think that one of the next big competitive advantages will come to clients or companies who are able to think about their innovation capabilities in the context of a global innovation network. I believe that there's challenges associated with that today. I think those that figure out how to build those networks, establish the global footprint, access global talent and capabilities and skills, and then to do all that by thinking about how to operate that network in the context of a virtual collaboration environment, I actually believe that's going to be one of the next big differentiators in terms of competitive advantage for companies in innovation.
Let's start with that idea and focus in on engineering for a moment. What are the big stumbling blocks for most companies when they offshore engineering?
Yeah, I think what we've seen in working with companies is, over the last couple of years, offshoring and outsourcing have been a hot topic. It's made its way from the back office into some of the more knowledge-intensive types of activities like engineering. Probably the biggest stumbling block that I've seen is companies that think about offshoring engineering and technical services types of activities is that they do it in the context of cost reduction through chasing labor arbitrage opportunities. And I think the stumbling block is that with that mentality, they potentially ignore or miss some of the real strategic advantages of thinking about establishing this idea of a global innovation network. And then in so doing, they miss a lot of the opportunities that Carl described, some of the real strategic advantages of this in the context of access to emerging markets or sort of the local interaction with customers and end users. Thirdly, around the access to critical skills, capabilities, talent in the context of the global supply base, and potentially fourth, miss thinking about it in, well, how is this really going to take the performance levels of my innovation process and capability to the next level in terms of, you know, faster, more efficient, more throughput through the innovation pipeline. And so the real stumbling block is getting caught up in the near-term focus on utilizing it as a means by which we reduce cost and missing the real opportunity to think about it strategically and ultimately how to create competitive advantage by doing that.
I think it's also useful to think about what specific tasks the firm or what specific decisions the firm faces in thinking about outsourcing. And one decision is clearly the boundary of the firm. That is, are you outsourcing to a, or are you globalizing by outsourcing to an independent supplier in a distant location? Or are you creating a captive group of your own employees who would be in that distant location? But I think an even more important decision is one related to how you partition the task. And ideally, I think you want to find a way to partition the task so that the distant entity can really own the whole problem, so that you can provide a functional specification of what they need to achieve and not just outsource the micro-level tasks. So for example, instead of outsourcing the brake caliper, for design in India, for example, you might outsource the brake system and give ownership for the whole problem of how do you stop the car rather than just how do you design this particular part.
Yeah, our findings really reinforce Carl's point there is that, you know, as we have gotten into focused in on engineering and technical services types of activities, we've seen a continued progression sort of to higher levels of value add sort of up the food chain, where many companies start with the rudimentary, repetitive engineering types of activities. But we've seen precisely what Carl alluded to, is that the more sophisticated ones continue to progress up that value-added chain, looking at much more complex activities, looking at entire subsystem design, ultimately looking at being responsible for the entire product development process for a, you know, for a particular solution. And so it's a continued progression to more and more higher value, more and more knowledge intensive types of activities and capabilities that companies are increasingly looking to satisfy through the global supply base.
But doesn't that run up against the problem of giving away the family jewels, so to speak? I mean, hasn't the argument against outsourcing whole systems been that you're also giving away your intellectual property?
Yeah, and that's really the right balance to strike in terms of understanding what really is the core of the core, what is the real critical product know-how, technological know-how, and understanding where to draw those boundaries. Many of the engineered products types companies that I work with, I mean, that fundamentally is the essence of those companies. It's the product know-how, it's the technological know-how. And so really understanding and having the ability to understand what that core of the core really is and draw the appropriate boundaries is the trick to getting it.
Is that a moving target?
It can be a moving target, yeah.
But my experience is that firms tend to overestimate what their unique capabilities are. And more often than not, a supplier who's out there earning its living by competing is going to be better than your captive group at a lot of these subsystems.
Aside from segmenting projects and sending over one component of, say, an engineering project to an outsourcing firm, how can globalized innovation teams collaborate across borders? Are you seeing any new modes or new models for collaboration emerging, new technologies that enable collaboration, for instance?
There are lots of modes that are emerging. Let me describe one that's kind of wacky, but kind of interesting. And as one I've used recently, a service I've used recently called Rent-A-Coder, where if you can write a specification for a piece of software fairly clearly, then in a matter of hours, you can get bids on that project from all over the world. And I recently, with a colleague here, developed a piece of software for use in my research, fairly complex piece of software, and ended up getting 200 or 300 quotes that ranged in price from, and these are shocking numbers, from $50 to $1,200 to do the software. And we ultimately picked a coder from Bulgaria named Monica, who was one of the top-rated coders at Rent-A-Coder, and she built our software for $300. And that's just a really remarkable phenomenon that's enabled by the ability to share information via the web, and also, frankly, by things like PayPal, by the ability to make small economic transfers across the planet. And that's probably not something that we hope, you know, the federal government will be using for missile defense system development, but it's a pretty interesting extreme point that's emerged just because of some of the technology we have.
I think there's fairly sophisticated technology solutions that will have emerged, and I think will continue to emerge in terms of collaboration. A lot of the product lifecycle management tools are increasingly becoming more sophisticated in terms of how they enable teams to collaborate virtually to ensure that there's, you know, full transparency and seamless transfer of data across the network. I also think there's some organizational dimensions to this. I was struck recently spending time in Bangalore and just how some of the most successful companies, you couldn't tell the differences in terms of the organization structure between the, you know, the folks working in Bangalore versus the folks working, you know, somewhere in the United States. It was really sort of a seamless and integrated organization construct, and they effectively managed it that way. So I think there's technology solutions, and there's some real organizational dimensions to the best practices here.
So other than the technological tools and the organizational adjustments that have to be made to collaborate across boundaries, what other approaches do you recommend companies take to take full advantage of the opportunity emerging countries offer?
Yeah, I think Carl alluded to a couple that come to mind to me. I mean, first and foremost, it's understanding, so what activities, what capabilities, in the context of what I talked about earlier, how do we segment what's appropriate in the context of core versus non-core, or, you know, any other screens that we want to think about? So, you know, first and foremost, what types of activities and capabilities? I think secondly, understanding where, in the context of the global supply base, there are a lot of pretty fundamental and inherent differences in terms of geographic regions around the world, specific countries. There's strengths and weaknesses and trade-offs associated with some of the inherent capabilities and some of the cultural issues within those countries themselves. And so, you know, that's really the second thing. Thirdly, it's really understanding these networks in the context of the operating model that's appropriate for a specific company, whether that's trying to establish this through joint ventures and alliances, through captive design centers, as we talked about, through third-party vendors. There's multiple operating models that have both strengths and weaknesses depending on what a particular company is trying to accomplish. A couple of other things around the infrastructure in terms of the transferability of information on one hand. That also, though, creates an issue on the other side, and that is, you know, how do we think about protecting our intellectual property, protecting that key product know-how, the technological know-how. And then I think finally it's to think about right up front how this will in fact create competitive and strategic advantage, and to design it with that kind of a thought process in mind of, you know, how do we want to structure this network in a way that it's going to really create competitive advantage for us relative to where we are in the industry?
Considering some of the models we've described, how do you see some of these models shifting in the next, say, 5 years or so, and what will drive those changes, some of these models of collaboration?
Well, let's think about what categories of drivers there would be. Certainly, there'll be continued technological change, although my sense is that the technological changes will be mostly better, faster, cheaper on dimensions we already have a pretty good idea about. I also think there can be changes in the regulatory environment and in the political environment that are going to have implications. We don't know exactly what trajectory China will end up on in terms of free enterprise, property rights, municipal control versus federal control. There are all kinds of issues in China that I think are going to have implications for the confidence with which non-Chinese will invest in China. So let's see, technology, regulatory and political. What else would you add, Kevin?
I think you're going to continue to see this progression that I talked about to more knowledge-intensive types of activities. I think, sort of given the historical progression of outsourcing and offshoring, generally speaking, I think you're going to see, in the case of innovation and engineering-related activities, some countries excel at more the front end, the real creative aspects of innovation, where at least in my experience, a lot of it to date has been focused more on the back end of the product development process. And so I think you'll see a migration of opportunities that will, in some cases, get into some of the real creative aspects of innovation.
Thank you for listening to part two of our series on innovation. In the final segment, Dehoff and Ulrich will discuss what can be learned from innovation in the automotive industry. For more insights about management, innovation, public policy, strategy, and more, visit Strategy and Business at strategy-business.com. For more business research and analysis from Knowledge at Wharton, visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.